Welcome back to the Live from the Podium series. Most organizations want to believe that a gender-balanced workforce is one of their top priorities. But is it really? This episode features three human resource and recruitment thought leaders that share the best practices and transformative thinking that is supporting the hiring and advancement of women and building a stronger, more equal, and more diverse Canadian workforce.
You. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Nice of you to be here today. Lisa, should I tell everyone what you said to me during the reception?
Ask me the easy
questions. Ask me the easy questions.
Not a chance.
Just kidding. Okay, this is going to be a great conversation. I welcome all of you for being here today, and everyone is so interested in what you have to say on this subject. A subject that, no matter what we seem to have done so far, is still one that is worthy of conversation. Despite the research, the corporate advocacy gaining attention in the news, mainstream media attention, there are still skeptics who devalue efforts to build gender-balanced workforces. Many people still see it as an equal rights issue, as opposed to something that's a business imperative or a key strategy for the overall success of the company. I'm going to start with you, Cheryl. Despite all the research, despite the time and attention that has been paid to this, give us some concrete examples of how organizations can benefit by having gender balance.
I just think I think she asked me to go first there because in the room beforehand I pointed out how frustrated I am with having to continue to prove the case. So I'm going to start off with a bad attitude, is that I'm personally very frustrated actually that we even have to have that conversation. So you guys can follow up on the frustration.
Awesome.
And I guess from two points of view. One is that I actually believe there's value in fighting for equal rights even if you don't have a proven economic case. So I have that to start off with. But coupled with the fact that when it comes to gender diversity and impact from an economic business point of view, we have literally been proving this for decades. The 30 years that I've been in the workforce, we've been studying it and making the case and proving it over and over and over again. So it bothers me that I think we still feel that we have to do that. This week there was a great report, and if you haven't seen it, I think it's called the Diversity Dividend, and it was through a pluralism project sponsored by the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, and it was looking at ethnic cultural kind of diversity benefits to the workforce, but they cut the data by gender, and it was honestly just a sidebar in this report, and the sidebar said that for every 1% increase in gender diversity, there was a 3.5% increase in revenue and a 0.7% increase in productivity. And that was just a sidebar. That was a throwaway comment, and that's an extremely compelling statistic on top of all the other compelling statistics that we've had for decades.
Lisa?
Okay, well, I share your frustration.
Thank you. I'm not the only bad attitude in the room.
No. But I have an advantage because I work in the human capital space, and there's a lot of great, talented women in the human capital space. So I live in a little false bubble. I go to work every day. 70% of our team members are female. 50% of our leadership team is female. I get the benefit of working in a diverse workforce every day, and our clients get the benefit of that breadth of thinking and range of capabilities and the voices and the points of view that kind of manifest as a result. So I feel like I had to remind myself to some extent that this is an issue. And it didn't take much to remind myself because, in fact, on the recruiting side, when we're dealing with our clients, we are often asked to help them in this regard. I have to say that I'm seeing much more uptake on the board side than I am on the executive side. So our comply or explain guidelines are really starting to have impact. And I haven't done a single board search in the last 2 years, and I think my colleagues would say the same, where we haven't been requested to bring forward a diverse slate. So that's very much, in fact, that's why companies are using search firms more and more, is to help create more diversity at the board table. I wouldn't say the same is true, though, for executive search. I think that it really is very situational. And we still see a lot of situations where companies will use culture. We're an old boys club. Women aren't going to succeed here. You better not bring us a woman. She's not going to succeed anyway. So we still get some of that language from our clients. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Different industries. Yeah, yeah. I'm sorry to say.
Really?
Yeah, really. It really is quite a mix of of what we see out there. One of the things I would say, though, I have one client in particular that I wanted to share the story of. This is a government agency, a provincial government agency, that has over 40% women on the board, over 40% women at the senior leadership level at the table, and they have had a fantastic run the last few years of really transforming their organization from a business perspective, from a process and culture perspective as well, and they have made themselves so attractive to female talent. So I was doing a little tally, and more than 50% of the people we've placed in this organization are women in various leadership roles across a range of functions. And I think, what these women are seeing, and men as well, is an organization that has women in leadership roles and is putting forth the right example and really being able to convey that, that theirs is an organization that women can flourish within. Hmm.
Michael.
So I won't be negative.
Thank you.
But I am highly medicated, so that's why. I live and breathe this stuff every day, so I guess there isn't as much negativity as I'm just completely numb from the neck up over it. I am amazed that we are not listening to the data. And I made this comment over lunch, and I'll repeat it, and that is, if I told you that you could, and I'm sorry to you looking at the bald spot, you could probably reflect there. If I told you that you could buy a house today, and the interest rate is 5%, but tomorrow it's 3%, you're going to wait to buy the house. Not in this market, but let's move on. Yet, if I told you, in 2007, that if you had three or more women on your board, you would have a return on equity of 46% higher than your competitors. Why would you not go and get three women on your board? Yet, that report came from Catalyst, 2007, am I getting the date? Great report, proved it within an inch of its life that we should do this. Yet, we still see the resistance to comply or explain. There was a whole lot of explain with comply or explain, and not a lot of comply. So it stuns me that data, if it's so black and white, right, yet it's not being listened to. And I think, as I've thought about this, a lot of it has to do with how we position it. I think to some extent we're still using the social justice language.
Okay, that's a good point.
So we say things like gender balance. Now, I'll be the controversial one in the room. I don't like that term because it makes me think of equal.
Right, 50-50.
50-50, that's never going to happen. Nursing, 90% of nursing graduates are women. Should we run out and get some men to go into nursing? No, men make a mess of everything. trucking, though, significantly lower women representation, it's trucking. Ew. So, I think we have to be a little realistic about some of that.
Right.
And talk about it from an innovation and creativity perspective. I want the best people at the table, but I recognize that I need a variety. It's not just the best people at the table, it's also making sure that you are picking from a very wide pool, whether it's around gender or gender identity, sexual orientation, religion, lived experience. Farah can tell you all, if she weren't on her BlackBerry, but she, I know, she's gonna cut me. She's tweeting about Malala. She's Malala. It was a tiny bit of jealousy, I'm not going to lie. But that lived experience. If I got a room full of people that went to U of T, fine institution, or Queens, I'll pick on Queens, great institution, but you all come from that same lens of learning. Whereas if you get a room full of people that went to Queens and Simon Fraser and George Brown and the Indian Institute of Technology, that's a better group of people because they think about things differently.
So instead of gender balance, you call it variety.
Yeah, I when I think about words like equality or balance, of course it's equality. I want to know that that goes without saying now, to the point about the exhaustion that we're still having this conversation.
Yeah.
And you know, we talk about women graduates. Women account for 60% of undergraduate degrees. Well, they've counted for more than 50% since 1979. So we have to change the conversation here or we're not going to move on.
Lisa, I feel like you've been nodding and you wanted to jump in.
I'm just in total agreement. No, I think that that diversity obviously is beyond balance, beyond equal. I think that there's so much to be gained, and I think everyone in the room has experienced this and knows firsthand how much organizations have to benefit by bringing that diversity of thought and of experience to the organization and to the benefit of their customers. It's so undeniable that I think what we're hearing here and what we're all agreeing to today is, you know, what is the stumbling block? Why?
Right. And we're going to get to that. Yeah,
yeah. This is the case, and why aren't we there?
Do you want to add anything, Cheryl, before we move on to the next?
I guess the two things jumped in my head when Michael was speaking. One is a worry, is that if we get too quickly to a very diffuse, it's just about variety and having variety of thought and diversity of everything, that's too unfocused, and it can actually take the attention off doing some very specific things to tackle very specific barriers, whether it's for gender or racialized groups or whatever that particular barrier is. So I worry about that.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
And I think a lot about, to your point, if there's a fact and business people are ignoring that fact, that seems ridiculous. Like if honestly, 1% change in gender and we could get 3.5% revenue, like why, Dervla, are we not signing up for that? And when I think about that, I haven't finished thinking about this, so this may be a half-baked thought, but I think it's because that's not a business problem, it's a business opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think business leaders are great problem solvers. So if they have a problem in their business, they'll be all over, what do I have to do to fix this? We're framing this data up as, here's an opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to go out and do something in order to bring that value into your organization. So I think it's a very different thing, and I think that goes to a different way of framing up the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very good.
Let's talk about how. Where do organizations begin, to your last point? Many organizations have diversity written right into their policy, their mandate, their mission statement. How can we bring those values to life? What initiatives have you seen that actually do work? And Lisa, I'm going to start with you on this one.
Okay, so, you know, internally, inside an organization, I probably have a little less perspective on insofar as, you know, I get brought in when it comes to bringing talent from the outside in. And as I mentioned at the outset, I'm in that enviable position of being part of an organization that kind of organically and naturally became very gender balanced very early on in its inception. But you know what I have heard and what I believe does work from the standpoint of kind of having the host, as I call it, the host environment, be ready to embrace and accommodate and accept and be able to excel at bringing on board female leaders and female talent. It starts at the top. It starts with a really deep and strong commitment by the CEO, ideally by the board, that is unwavering and fully on board with the idea that this is a priority for our business. It is an opportunity, but it has to become a mandate. And then from there, it has to cascade down into programs of development, programs of building communities of interest, you know, all the things that I think many of the organizations, people representing in this room, I know the banks, I know the large telecommunications companies, many other organizations have built significant programs around identifying and advancing women in the workplace. These cannot be nice to haves, these are must haves, and they have to have teeth, they have to have accountability built around them. So I think that's some of what needs to be done internally inside an organization, to have that organization be ready, to have the examples in place from a leader perspective to be the kind of environment that women want to work in.
camp.
Cheryl, what have you seen that works?
Maybe just picking up on that a little bit, and I'll go to data, because I am an analytical data-driven person, regardless of my first response here today. Like, forget the data, it means nothing. And that would be looking at kind of what the drivers are for people to stay with organizations or to move between organizations or to move out of the workforce altogether. And there's one study I've been carrying around for a couple of years, and it was a Cornell study on the drivers of retention, I think is what it was. But they took a specific cut through the data for different demographic groups. And I was interested in it because I figured, you know, I worked in this industry for a long time. I know what the drivers are. It's going to be career opportunity, and it's going to be compensation, and then maybe the third's going to be connectivity to managers and the people around you. And those are the drivers no matter where you go. But this particular study pulled out for that there was actually a statistically significant difference on a couple of different things specific to women. And if I'm remembering it right, one of them was lack of affiliation and association with the in-group, mm-hmm. or the power group in the organization. And the other one was lack of accommodation for need to have flexibility for people that have different demands on their time than the men in the organization that came before them. And those were the two big things. So the things that I've seen, work is a loaded term because clearly we're not all the way there yet, but to be very effective, tackle that. So anything that goes to create that kind of association with an in-group, to form that for yourself, whether it's affinity groups in an organization when you're pulling women together so you've got that critical mass and I can be part of this powerful group of people, create it for yourself. It can be external to the organization. It could be an industry group where you're getting together thought leaders in your industry and they're all women and you can feel that affiliation with the power that there is a critical mass and try and meet that need of women in a different way. And on the flexibility, I mean, obviously, we need to create and we need to actively promote. And I think, and this is my bias, I think we have to normalize the use of all of the flex programs that we put in place, whether it's flex time, shared working arrangements, maternity top-up, whatever the thing is, we have to make that normal. And part of what I think will normalize that is really more equal take-up by both genders. Okay. So I think anyone who's doing active work in there, and we're starting to look at how to do more active work there, I think that will have a big impact.
You want to pick up on that, Michael? Those are, how do you advance those?
That's good. I think you get men to use them. And yeah. It was a big thing for me at KPMG was to normalize them and to make sure that men were taking parental leave. The firm offered, I believe it was 4 weeks parental leave. And in the nearly decade I was there, no one ever took
yeah.
it.
Really?
Never.
That's the second time I've said that today.
It's a good one. And, you know, I can point to lots of studies that show that you know, fathers that have a bonded relationship with their infant child will grow up to have better relationships with their children, particularly in their teenage years. Why is that important? Don't bring your crap to work. Mm-hmm. I don't want you to bring your issues with your annoying little brats to work. So have a better relationship with your... I'm not great with kids.
And he's highly medicated,
and
so his filter's not working.
But you know, it's about making sure that you are able to come to work and do your job and not allow that stuff to get in the way. So definitely men, take advantage of those things and set the tone. And this is I was beating this barrel that, you know, men can work from home. You can work a flex week. You can work a reduced week. And it's okay. The world is not going to come to an end. And, you know, we don't see enough of that. We see women tending to take advantage of them, oftentimes out of necessity. But I think men need to step up and take more of a responsibility around the family. And women need to let them.
Why do you think, Cheryl, and to an extent you, Michael, as well, with the point that you're making on this, why are those things still sort of seen as fringy? Are people concerned about the perception that they won't get ahead? That
for sure, all the things that have stood in the way of women for all of these decades. Right. So as long as we continue
to be a differentiator. If it's still women that are primarily doing that, that's still something that creates women as the other. It's different. It can inspire thoughts of less commitment, distraction,
yep.
All of the fears and the anxieties and the biases that don't quite understand that, it allows people to continue to keep women in a different zone. So, I mean, that's why my hypothesis is that don't try and say that both of those are, and maybe that's where we end up, both of those are valid and they're normal and we accept them and people can fulfill their life dreams through either path, and one's primarily women and one's primarily men, and we could end up there. I think we'll get there better if it's more, people are making their choices and it's more evenly normalized across both genders.
I think it's also our definition of success. So I come from the accounting world. Success is partner. And does that need to be success? Is that, or is it just a really good career of doing really good work? And that's okay too. So it's changing our perception of what success means. It's also dealing with the unconscious bias that's at play, where how many people have been in a promotion conversation or a performance management conversation, and you're talking about a man and you're talking about his ability to do his job and his market and et cetera, and then all of a sudden you're talking about the woman and her family seems to come into the conversation. Not that, you know, I mean, men do play a role in the baby making process. It is a very limited role.
Really? I'm just kidding.
And they say they love their children.
Absolutely. They will pay good money to, but they need to step up and be a part of that. And I think a big part of this will be, I hate to do this, but the next generation, millennials who are coming into the workforce are advancing and saying, your version of success and my version of success are two totally different things.
Right.
And they're okay with not making partner.
I can comment a little on that as well. I'm in the enviable position. I have lots of enviable positions, apparently. But years ago, my husband decided to put his career on hold, and actually he stayed home and raised our kids. And I know a lot of professional women that, you know, have had a very similar situation where the woman's career took precedence over the man's, and in some cases the man stayed home and raised the family, and, you know, in that dynamic we create a very different story for our children. And my children are now in their 20s, and their view of, you know, what those gender roles are all about, obviously, you know, are have been shaped through that experience as much as through their generation. So I think you're right, Michael. I think that the millennials, to some extent, will hold the key because they won't put up with what they, you know, saw their parents have to put up with in the workforce, and their definition of success is different. And I think that, you know, we can all, in our individual lives, you know, have those conversations and realize that we're all, you know, in our own families, in our own relationships, setting examples for the next generation. So it's personal as well as it is a business issue.
Mm-hmm. And I have to throw a piece of data onto the table just because we were talking about it before, and it shook me up actually, because I've been thinking that maybe this next generation and what we know of them, and there were some basic differences there in how they were schooled and brought up that would start to feed through the system. And it was an article in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, and it was, there's a study they've been doing in the States for 40 years on high school seniors, and it's the same questions they've been asking for 40 years. And they've seen a marked uptick in the percentage of these kids who believe that the best family situation is with the man being a primary earner and the women taking care of the home. And it was a material trend. The trend had been going down, and now there's an uptick.
Yeah.
And this article, it's in the Times, and you can find it online. And they brought in some other studies to try and dig at why. And I mean, there's hypotheses about it. One of which is being they saw their parents who didn't have the enviable situation of yours, where there were dual career families, and it was very difficult. And we're living in an unusual time where people are afraid of where things are going, and they're maybe hearkening back to a day that they think, well, if my parents, it didn't work, maybe I want what they used to have. And mm-hmm. So, I don't think we can be complacent that anything's going to just work its way through the system. I think we have to continue to keep our eye on it.
Well, let's talk about roadblocks on that point. how can someone drive change if they don't have the necessary buy-in from their team, from their boss, from senior leadership? And you mentioned unconscious bias, which is a real catchphrase this day, these days. How do you eliminate that, overcome it? And Michael, I will start with you on this one.
You have to have leadership buy-in.
Yeah.
That's the end of the discussion. If you do not have tone from the top, this goes nowhere. And the grassroots, the boiling up is critically important, and you need that energy. You need people who have a personal passion around this, all of you in the room today. That commitment is important, but if the CEO of Scotiabank isn't buying, this is not going to happen. It just doesn't work like that, unfortunately. That wasn't very inspiring.
No!
It's a mic drop.
It's very real. Lisa?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I think that's everyone's immediate response. You know, maybe I'm not even working in the right organization if my organization doesn't believe in this. Maybe the answer isn't, what do I do to change it? Maybe I leave and go and work somewhere else where I can be part of an organization that shares my values and is committed to advancing women and diversity in the workforce. Not everybody will make that choice or can make that choice. So, you know, I think if you're trying to come up with sort of a game plan, a little bit of an approach that could create some advancement inside an organization, you know, I think you've got to look at it as a change management exercise. At the end of the day, you know, we work through change management initiatives all the time. Change can happen from the middle. And this change can happen from the middle. It'll take longer, and it's not easy, but we create spheres of influence. We build communities that share our common view and common perspective. We use data. Yeah. We create a story around that data. Maybe we try not to get people too cranky with us if they don't believe in the data. Maybe you try to work around those folks. But you can build some momentum inside the organization and outside the organization through communities like Women of Influence and other organizations. So I think, too, that in the middle of an organization, if you're a hiring manager, you can create your own proof case. You can create it by saying, I am going to hire women. I am going to put the extra effort in to look beyond the usual suspects. I'm going to prove by doing this that I'm going to get the benefit out of having these women on my team. And then I'm going to use my own example as the case to help make that happen across the organization.
I think you take a more grassroots outlook on this.
I don't disagree at all that you need to make material systemic. The big changes, it needs executive sponsorship. But I think you have to work things to the point. You have to work it from all different angles. And you have to work it within organizations. You have to work it outside of organizations. There's a big societal thing we have to be working, whether it's policy, childcare policy, leave policy, where you spend your money, but there are things you can do within an organization. And I did think about this a little bit today for this group, because I love to be with groups like this where I think there's all these people that just want to do something. Mm-hmm. They just want to go out and do something. And, you know, what's the call to action? Somebody please go find something. And I can't say I've got a magic bullet, but it ties back a little bit to the find a business problem. And that's how I've changed my thinking a little bit, because you can do this in very grassroots. You can do it in a team. You can say, we have this business problem to solve. Now let's analyze it. Find a way to bring in some data to say, here's a way we could solve that problem in this way. And things where you can, a very simple example could be, if you have a turnover rate and we know we can quantify what turnover costs, and if we can quantify more women than men are leaving, which we probably can because that's statistical, there's a problem, it's costing us money. Even if it's in a small group of people, let's get together, equal men, equal women, anybody can do this. And let's just talk about why. And have no guiding questions, let's just uncover it ourselves and start to create the narrative around it that might swell up into people discovering the solutions and the problems themselves. So that's a very grassroots way you can kind of get more people to think about it. And I think as well about some of the things we know about marketing, we have to use better. So there's all kinds of great work being done, like on neuroscience and marketing, to understand what kind of messaging even activates the part of your brain that pays attention versus what you remember versus what connects to you and you actually want to take action on. Well, why don't we take that and study the messages? So clearly we've not been doing it all the way right. There's a huge opportunity. We can't just keep doing the same things and muscling through. We have to do things differently. So let's bring in some different techniques in way of blowing away our own assumptions. Maybe there's a different way to tackle this and tell the stories. And in the meantime, don't stop doing all that other stuff because it keeps momentum. But I want to do something big and different.
Yeah, and maybe if I can correct my record for a second and be a little less of a wet blanket, I think it does take somebody standing up and one person who says, we're going to have a change here. And I did it at KPMG. I've seen others do it with organizations where I stepped up and I said, we need to do this, and here's why. And I created the business case, and I went to the leadership, and I got it approved, and I suddenly had a different job. That movement has to happen.
In a good way.
In a good way.
He wasn't saying you got fired.
He wasn't fired.
That's right. Yeah. I got promoted. There has to be that grassroots passion. But eventually, it does have to hit the top of the house and become as important to them as it is to you.
Yeah. And chances are, if you're thinking that, 9 times out of 10, other people are.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Yes.
For
absolutely.
Sure. Yeah. All right, well, let's end on a positive note.
Okay.
How can we say we've made it? So in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years from now, this conversation is no longer being had. What will it look like when we're there?
The unicorn frappuccino.
Yeah, we won't be here because we won't need to be here.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We'll be sitting out there listening to somebody else talk about other
things. On an entirely different subject.
Absolutely.
Okay, Michael, I'll start with you.
How we know we're successful, I'm a measurement junkie. Data, 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 data. Yeah. You've got to measure it. You've got to ask questions and be prepared for the answers and deal with the answers. And it's a continual progress. It's a continual journey. If you take your foot off the pedal for even a moment, it all falls apart. You regress. And we've seen that so many times in 2008 when the economy did its thing. We watched organizations cut diversity and inclusion budgets, and we watched them regress. So you've got to keep going forward. Even, I call it the incremental revolution. This is not about huge, massive initiatives. It's about every day changing a little bit so that the change becomes natural. It becomes part of who you are as an organization, and then measure it within an individual's life.
Lisa?
Well, if I look at it from a recruitment perspective, I would say, you know, what's going to look different? The short list. The candidates
Absolutely.
That are under consideration for any leadership role, potentially not truck drivers. But,
I'm telling you,
you know, I would say that, you know, we do want to be more comprehensive, and I think we're there when every short list has an equal number of men or women, or potentially in some cases more women than men, and maybe in some cases more men than women, and that's okay, because we've made it, so to speak, and we are such a long way from that moment, and I have a lot of faith, notwithstanding that study, in the millennials, because I think they care about things differently. I have a lot of faith in the programs that companies are implementing, and I believe that you know, that every time there are more women on the recruiting side, on the receiving side of that recruitment conversation, there are more female candidates that feel that's a welcoming place, that I can make a difference. So it might be incremental, but I think we can get there. I'm very much a cup half full kind of person. I just don't know when it's going to happen. Like, I don't know what the time frame is, and I suspect that that's, you know, one of the things that we would really like to push and should push, and definitely not take our foot off the pedal, because I think it could take 20 years, and we'd probably like to see it in 5.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, final thought from you.
I guess I'm an eternal optimist on this. I honestly am trying to work to a world where we don't have to have programs and policies and conversations, and we don't notice
if we walk into a room and it happens to be, it's a leadership room and it happens to be three quarters women and nobody says, well, what are they trying to prove? Like, I honestly want to get to a point where we don't need to muscle through it, and if we take our foot off the gas, we'll regress, because that implies that it's still somehow risky and less to hire women or racialized people or whatever the group is that's marginalized. And I'm going to keep working this until we don't need programs and conversations.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I believe you.
You're here.
I believe you. Thank you all. I really appreciate what you had to say. And dissenting views and opinions always make the conversation more lively and certain, and more lively and more enjoyable and more informative.